Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, the 27th of July, 1999, and in Quenya Fireside Room this afternoon, we will hear Nancy Barry's session called Writing Down the Bones, number 99-2. Let's listen in.
Barry, this is a workshop called Writing Down the Bones, a continuation of our work and talk yesterday about the writing process. Let me recap a little bit of where we are, or not so much where we are. Bring those of you who are new today, first time, that's fine. Try and kind of tell you a little bit of where we are. Theoretically, what I'm talking about this whole week is premised on what I call three influential books about the writing process, and I've just noted them down here. This is the one that's in the bookstore, but the one I talked about yesterday is Peter Elbow, Writing Without Teachers, first 1973, second edition 1998. The book I'll talk about today is Natalie Goldberg, Writing Down the Bones, first published in 1986, 13 years after Elbow's work. She has a more recent book called, I think it's Wild Mind, and it was published sometime in the 90s, but I'm not, can't quite remember. Anybody know Natalie Goldberg's work? So she has kind of two books about writing. She also has a novel, I think it's called The Blue Highway. And more recently, there's a just tremendous writing book. Those of you who are interested in the writing process, I cannot recommend it highly enough, by Anne Lamott. It's entitled Bird by Bird. It was published in 1997. All three of these books are of a kind, which is to say they explore the writing process not for particular projects. There are some writing books that are what I would call project-oriented books. How to write a memoir, how to write a screenplay. Russell Hills's book on writing fiction. So there are lots of reference books guiding you in a particular genre. And there's a whole other category of writing books, probably which most of us know from our academic lives, which is books, handbooks. The most famous example of this is the one by E.B. White, Strunk and White's Elements of Style, a book that grew out of what E.B. White learned from a series of lectures from his professor Strunk at Harvard College. And White sort of took these, it's a fascinating story about how writing books come to be. He took a series of, Strunk was a famous professor. Grammarian, had a set of writing instructions to all his classes at Harvard, and he said he codified them in a thing called the Little Red Book. He actually sort of composed for the students there a Little Red Book. It existed in the locus just of that college. Later, years later, in the 1940s and 50s, I think it was, E.B. White is an essayist, a regular contributor to the New Yorker magazine. And he begins to sort of do some memoir work about what Mr. Strunk taught him as a writer. And he codified that in some essays that were printed in the New Yorker. An editor at Macmillan Publishing Company read those and called E.B. White one day and said, you know, this is great advice for writers. Why don't you put this into a book? And that's how it happened that Strunk and White's Elements of Style was born. Probably sold more copies in the United States than any other writing book. That book, it represents to me the most popular or well-known example of what I call the writing handbooks that all of us received or crossed paths with one way or another in school. These are books that prescribe rules, they give you instructions, there's a set of types. If you want to write a comparison contrast essay, here's how you do it. If you want to write a narrative essay, here's how you do it. And so there's those kinds of, and one of the things that I think my thesis here this week is that it's very important for writers to learn what kind of resource they need when in the writing process. If there's any way that I would describe the writing process of for people who often get frustrated with it, it's that the process has become undifferentiated. In other words, you sit down to write, and you start, and you stop, and when you look at your writing, you're doing a similar thing all the time. And you're not being very emphatic or descriptive about where it is you're starting And what is it that you want at the end when you think or know the thing is finished? That in essence, what you do is the same thing over and over again, which is write, reread, write, reread, write, reread. But if someone were to say to you, what's the difference between the way your mind is acting as a reader here? Let's just ascribe days to these processes. Let's just call this day one, day two, day three, day four, day five, which of course for most of us in significant writing projects is years and not days. If someone were to say to writers, what's the difference between the way you're acting and operating intellectually as a writer and a reader on day five from day one? The writer would say, well, I don't know. It's the same thing. It's just another day. And part of my shtick here this week is to encourage you to begin to think about the process as largely organic, very recursive. You do kind of go backwards at certain moments in the process and recreate your mindset at day one. But also each of these moments in the writing process has a kind of different window or lens that you put on the process as a writer and a reader and an editor. And I think if you think about the writing process as differentiated, depending on where you are with a particular project, it might be a little more fruitful. Okay, let me just review Elbow's thesis here, and then we'll get to some free writing and talk about Natalie Goldberg's book, Writing Down the Bones. Quoting from Elbow here, there is a paradox about control which this kind of writing brings into the open. The common model of writing I grew up with preaches control. It tells me to think first, make up my mind what I really mean, figure out ahead of time where I'm going, have a plan, an outline, don't dither, don't be ambiguous, be stern with myself, don't let things get out of hand. As I begin to try and follow this advice, I experience a sense of satisfaction and control. Quote, I'm going to be in charge of this thing and keep out of any swamps. Yet almost always my main experience ends up one of not being in control, feeling stuck, feeling lost, trying to write something and never succeeding, helplessness and passivity. The developmental model, on the other hand, preaches, in a sense, lack of control. Don't worry about knowing what you mean or what you intend ahead of time. You don't need a plan or an outline. Let things get out of hand. Let things wander and digress. Though this approach makes for initial panic, my overall experience with it is increased control. Not that I always know what I'm doing, not that I don't feel lost, baffled, and frustrated, but the overall process is one that doesn't leave me quite so helpless. I can get something written when I want to. There isn't such a sense of mystery or of randomness. This paradox of increased overall control through letting go a bit seems paradoxical only because our normal way of thinking about control is mistakenly static. And, you know, there's a biblical precedent for this in the New Testament. Lose yourself to find yourself, right? So there is a way in which this process, although none of these writers would perhaps ground themselves, at least in their written texts, in a Christian tradition, I do think this notion of writing as a developmental process toward knowledge, and more importantly, writing as a paradoxical relationship to knowledge, I think that is very, very close to what to some of the mysteries that we've been talking about this week, particularly what Dan was saying this morning in his discussion of the Book of Daniel. So all three of these writing books are guides to that kind of process, toward the paradox of letting go and finding meaning, right? As I said yesterday, writers do not write from meaning, they write toward meaning. And each of these writers in their own way will encourage that and give you a different set of strategies and tropes and exercises to encourage that sort of approach to it. What happened yesterday or this morning in any of the free writing stuff? Anybody care to just... We won't probably read or share any writing perhaps until Thursday when I talk about actually running a writing workshop. But anybody have anything that they want to report about the process? Surprises? Anybody avoid it? Anybody say, oh, it just really doesn't feel like that good a time anymore. I'm out of that room. I don't really want to do it. I was that way last night. I just didn't want to write. Anything to report? What you learned?
I was up till midnight writing two different stories that inspired me for the conversation.
Okay, so two different stories. Mm-hmm. Did you go at them with free writing stuff?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And what was how long do you think you sustained that free writing spurt?
Probably about 2 or 3 hours.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's great. Anything else?
My 10 minutes went pretty fast, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
Faster than I thought.
Mm-hmm.
As I look back on it, I thought it was kind of conversational.
Right.
More so than I would normally have written outside of this setting.
Conversational in terms of hearing your voice? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Anybody else notice that? That there seemed to be kind of an immediacy and a sense of voice? Did you?
Mm-hmm. I noticed the opposite, that I slipped into the language I use when I write papers.
Yeah. And do you like that voice?
Oh, it's fine. It just wasn't what I expected.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's got to be there. It's got to be there. Maybe it's because your father's been sending you books about Shakespeare. You know, we just had a conversation about this in the mailroom. Anybody else? Any other surprises? What about this thing about finding the center of gravity, of lifting out places where the energy is in the writing? Anybody pursue that as an exercise and learn something about that as in terms of its validity? Anything about that? Yes, no? Any thoughts about that? Yes? Did you want to say? No. Okay.
Can you explain what that is?
Sure, sure. Here's how to describe this method, right? You got an hour. You've got an hour of writing time. And most of us would say within that hour we're gonna stew and fret,
make coffee,
do the dishes, right? I always love doing the dishes. There's something about a kitchen that just calls you when you want to, you know, right? So you've got 60 minutes. Well, Elbow's and Goldberg's impetus advice here is force yourself to write for maybe 10 minutes at first, maybe 20, for as long as you can keep the energy moving forward on the page. Here's the list of prerequisite that Goldberg says. Keep your hand moving. Don't pause to reread the line you have just written. That's stalling and trying to get control of what you're saying. Don't pause. That's why this very physical thing of keeping yourself moving, right? It's like it is like physical exercise. You know, you gotta keep running. You gotta keep swimming. You gotta just keep doing it. Don't cross out. That is editing as you write. Even if you write something you didn't mean to write, leave it. Don't worry about spelling, punctuation, and grammar. Don't even care about staying within the margins and lines on the page. Lose control. Lose control. Don't think. Don't get logical. Go for the jugular. And this is where she's particularly adds an even more emphasis on her own work in Zen Buddhism. Peter Elbow really does come out of an academic tradition in which he's trying to sort of say, I know it seems crazy writing academic papers, this is a model, but he has found that it's successful. Natalie Goldberg is very much a writer who has tapped into the Buddhist tradition of meditation, the paradox of knowledge and where it comes from and what we do with it once we get it. And so that's why she very much says, go for the jugular. If something comes up in your writing that is scary or naked, dive right into it. It probably has lots of energy. Okay? So the point is, you do that for minutes, however many, 10, 20, 45, 2 hours. It is a physical thing. It is a physical thing. Right? You want your children to get ready to go to school or college where they're going to write? Just say to them, you know, let's just do this game. Let's just both try to write as much as we can for 20 minutes. Because there's a physical stamina that gets in the act of writing as much as any other physical labor or intensity that we do. But anyway, so back to Heidi's question here. So this is the free writing stuff, right? This is free writing. That's what we talked about yesterday. So what do you do with that portion of time that's after that? Well, the first thing you do is take a deep breath. And then you look at it. You look at it. And you ask yourself, not is it any good? Is it bad? Is it junk? Is it garbage? Right? Not the evaluator. Never, never at this stage of the writing process, the evaluator and the editor and the judger, the judgment maker, the critic. Never that. But you simply try to act almost like an anthropologist. You say, what have I got? What have I got? And so you look at the writing in order to see these pinch points, these places where the energy seems to rise up off the page, either because what you've said is so startling, or because what you've said is so surprising, or because there's so much energy attached to it, you can't avoid it, right? And that's in the midst of just describing. You just want to describe what you've got. What's it about? Is this writing were a color, what color would it be? Okay? And then one of the phrases that Elbow, this does come from Elbow, that he uses to help you push the writing further is center of gravity. And I was actually looking for his description of what that is, because my paraphrase of it yesterday was probably a little vague here. Here's his description of it. What this means in practice is that in a piece of writing, you must force yourself to keep getting some center of gravity or summing up to occur. Okay, that is, let's see here, this is not the exact. That it is the moment when there was chaos is now seen as having a center of gravity. A center of gravity can be a sentence, it can be an idea, it can be a phrase, it can be one word. It's not the thesis statement. It's not the thesis statement. It is the thing inside a piece of writing that is collecting energy and sending out energy all at the same time. That's what we're talking about here. And who finds that center of gravity? Well, two people find it. Writers find it. You identify it. Okay? And that's what I talked about yesterday. You identify it, you lift it out of that free writing, and you put it at the top of a piece of paper. And then you write more. The other people who define that center of gravity is readers. Well, and one of the things that happens then as we move forward in the process is that we ask readers to tell us what they got as the center of gravity. And it's not a test. It's not a quiz. It's not like this thing in Daniel, you know, tell me my dream. That's not it. What it is you just listen to what readers got as a center of gravity. And then you, as the writer, make a decision about why they might have gotten that, where it is in the text that it occurred, and whether or not you want to draw that one out, or in fact, push the reader possibly closer to the one that you wanted. So center of gravity is a, again, yesterday I used the phrase, three-dimensional thing that seems to sort of attract attention to itself. If you were going to strip away everything out of this free writing, what would you hold on to? What would you hold on to? Is that, Heidi, does that help a little bit?
I think so. Yeah. What I was thinking is, when you said description, I was thinking it was more in terms of saying, oh, this looks like it's going to be a poem, or this looks like it's going to be a memoir, this looks like it's going to be an essay.
Right.
You're talking about something really rather, I mean, that's almost getting to the too academic side.
Right.
You're talking about an energy source.
Right. I'm talking in the text itself. Right. But I do think that when we write something that starts reminding us of certain forms, what's your name?
Betsy,
when, in the process of writing, last night, did you realize you were actually creating a story? Was it right from the start?
Not right away.
Yeah.
It happened.
Yeah. And see that, so I think in the process, when you really are just working to sort of figure what have I got, what am I doing, I think there's no doubt that these genres, these forms of writing, argument, right, that they have come to us as, oh, it sounds a lot like, or it feels like. Okay, What's your name again, sir?
Gordon.
Gordon. Gordon, and there was another woman who talked to me at dinner yesterday who had a question. Was it you? Did you talk? No, is it? No. Somebody else talked to me yesterday. Two questions that came up, and they were essentially, well, all this free writing stuff is very fine and good, but I'm working in the real world in which I have to, you know, there are tasks. Students have to write a paper on Shakespeare's Henry V. Or one, the woman who talked to was a lawyer, and she said, you know, I've got to produce briefs. I've got to produce reports on case law. And Gordon, you talked about this a little bit about writing about things related to business, right? And it is true that rarely in our intellectual lives are we totally free, right? That is to say, frequently we are called upon to write for a particular task and for a particular audience and for a particular event. And here's how I think the model still works for that. When you're mindful of what it is that you've got to end up with, and you're mindful of using text, that is to say, writing from text in response to a literary work or a historical question or a sociological problem, this process still holds. What you do is you fill the well, we fill the well of our minds with that stuff, right? It's there. We take it in. And then we put it aside and we write, free write for 10 minutes or 15 minutes or 20 minutes and figure what it is that we have to say from that. And this is the genesis of Anne of Lamott's Bird by Bird. Have you read that book? Who's read that book? Anybody else? Couple of folks. It's a fabulous book. I can't recommend it highly enough. And here's where the title of it comes from, Bird by Bird. Her brother, in the seventh grade or so, had a classic middle school project, which is to do a paper on birds of North America. And he went after, you know, he did everything you're supposed to do. He loved birds. He was not resistant to this writing project. He loved birds. He collected all this information about birds. And, of course, the night before the paper was due, he went ballistic. Because he's got, you know, 25 pictures and 25 encyclopedia entries and 25 different birds. And his father, who happened to be a writer as well, Annie Lamott's father, also was a writer, he said to this young boy, her brother, I can't remember his name, addressed him and said, just calm down and take it bird by bird. And that's the genesis of the title. But it's also her advice to writers, which is one thing at a time, and then she uses this metaphor of the one-inch frame. The one-inch frame. So those of you who are writing for particular tasks, you know, response to Shakespeare's sonnet, why did the War of 1812 start? Who is to be held accountable in my business plan for packaging and supply? Read all the stuff you're supposed to read to help you answer that question. Let it cook in your mind, But then, still, 15 minutes of free writing. Right, force yourself to push through as fast or as much as you can, and then look at what you got. Okay? Questions? Responses? Yeah, go ahead.
So we're looking at this method of free write as a tool for all writing.
I believe it can be useful for all writing types and situations. Are you skeptical of that?
I don't know. I'm
going to
listen more.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think the skepticism, sort of in the questions that I got after the session, there was a little bit of skepticism in that they were saying we're more driven by task and form and audience than the free writing model suggests. And I think that's probably true, especially the older we get and the more pressure we have to produce things within a short period of time. I think there's no doubt about that. But I think the value of this model is that it's sort of a basis by which we remind ourselves of another approach to the writing process, which is not to be driven. not to be driven entirely by task and audience and form and control, but to make sure that there's a portion of the project, a portion of the project and the process somewhere along the line where we let it all in and we really give ourselves the chance to discover what it is we have to say about this.
And if I don't do that, I run the risk of missing something.
That's right. Yeah.
That I could say, it isn't going to come if I'm sitting there logically kind of going piece by piece. It's only when I let it explode that some of that stuff surfaces. Also, it's a good way to get through writer's block.
Absolutely.
When I get stuck.
Absolutely.
It's like, I say, oh, the hell with it, and I just start writing.
Yeah, yeah, right. You got lower writer's block, lower your standards. And you know, write through why, well, not so much even why you're stuck, but just force yourself to keep going, you know, as a dialogue. Yeah, go ahead.
So would you suggest the complete abandonment of like outlines before a writing task and brainstorming?
What are the ways that people do you call it pre-writing, right?
Pre-writing. Yeah, I just.
So one of them is outlines, right? How many of us use them when we write? Sometimes, yeah. What are they good for? What are the pluses and what are the negative features of them? Well, those of you who use them and they're helpful, why are they helpful?
They give
organization.
Form.
Organization. Pardon my spelling on this. As I said yesterday, I'm one of those writing teachers who's not very particular, especially in teaching mode about this. So they give you organization, they give you form. What else?
They give you something, make sure you've got all your points together.
So you know
you're not forgetting
you're
a point.
Right. So they help you gather all your points.
Right.
Okay.
And have them right there for you.
Right there. Okay.
And make your choices.
Making choices. Okay, so they do act to sort of control or at least guide the choices that you have to make. Right? Anything else that they help you with?
They keep you from wandering.
Yeah.
It's direction.
Right. They limit the task. Direction. Okay. Now.
They raise the question of transition.
Okay.
From
how so, sir?
To another. How do I get from this point to that?
Right. Okay. So in the midst of giving direction. They do sort of smooth you between one point to the next.
I think it's also a good way to go word by word. When you sit down and write and you have an outline, you can say, I'm going to do it this topic.
Right.
Topic.
Yeah, word by word is an outline, right? And so is the one-inch frame. Okay? Liabilities of that is a process, yeah.
It assumes you know what you're going to talk about before you write.
Right. Mm-hmm. Assumes that this organization and that this sense of direction is solid. Right? Is solid.
It assumes you've read Henry V before you start to write about it.
Yeah, well that's a whole other thing. That's a whole other thing. Yeah, it's funny, I teach at Luther College and it isn't. The first year course is a text-based course. There are different kinds of writing courses for students in high school and college, and some of them are experience-based, writing autobiography, writing out of experience. Some of them are what we call rhetorically based, that is to say, you do a series of one essay on comparison-contrast, one essay on narration, one essay on pro-con. And then there are some at Luther that are what I call text-based. We're asking students to write based on their reading. And I supervise tutors in that course, and the tutors, they have meetings, obviously, and the tutors come in, they say, you know, there's one situation that I just never know what to say. And I say, what's that? And they say, well, it's when they come in and they say, I got to write a paper on the Odyssey, and then they say, well, what do you think about, you know, what's drawing you to the Odyssey? And then they say, well, you know, I haven't read it. And, I think that's another issue. When you're beginning a writing task, and usually this is when they're assigned, okay, and you've resisted doing the work that will get you started on the task. But in self-sponsored writing projects, you know, yesterday I used that phrase, self-sponsored writing projects, when you really are the one who's saying, I want to write a book on, I want to write a memo on, I want to write a letter on, in self-sponsored writing project, the key thing, though, is this whole thing of almost almost readiness, but I don't, you know, that's, again, it's the paradox. We do collect stuff. One of the things that's not an outline is collecting, right? And we'll get to that in a minute. Okay, so here we go. That was a digression. Assumes you know, outlines assume you know, I don't even know what I was writing here, where you're going and what you know. Right. Anything else? Any other liabilities?
I don't know how to explain this exactly, but it sort of limits your inquiry. I mean, you might get into a project and you say, well, this is my outline, this is what I've got to know, but it sort of limits you from asking further questions.
That's right.
I'm not sure if I can explain that, but if this is all I have to do, well, then
that's
even if I'm interested, you know, oh, look at what I can learn. Oh, you know, I mean, it kind of limits that.
That's right.
That inquiry.
That's right. It provides a map.
Yeah.
And so if you've got a map that looks like this and something appears over here in a train of thought or a digression, but it's not in the map, and the amount of work it takes for you to let that in and get it back inside of this scheme, right, is that's frightening. That's really frightening. And so I think it is fair to say that outlines can be limited. What else? Any other liabilities? Yeah.
They maybe suppress like creative outbursts or really creative moments that maybe wouldn't fit. I think it's similar to what she said.
Right, that this idea that the nature of an outline is an ordered scheme. That's what it is. How many of all of us have said, well, I'm not completely panicked about my paper because I've got an outline for it.
Yep.
Right? So, you know, I've got an outline for this sermon. I
know I'm going.
And that helps, right? That helps allay the anxiety. The problem is when we are controlled by it, when it does really act as the only scheme and map, it could be that our mind is, again, cooking, right? Our mind is cooking and generating lots of stuff on this topic, which this is not even aware of, right? Yes, sir.
On the other hand, the outline may be overwhelming.
How so?
Well, it may encompass so much that one does not feel like you can tackle the whole thing.
That's true. That's a very real thing. That's right. That outlines can in fact daunt us as well as guide us. Yeah, the woman next to you.
I have a question that I'm in education at the elementary level. They talk a lot now about graphic organizers. Right. Is this a type of graphic organizer, or is it a web? And there are other types of graphic organizers too.
Yeah. Can I get to that in just a minute? I'm going to talk about that as another what we call heuristic. That is to say, a way of pre-writing and getting stuff arranged in the mind. Yes.
Something I always had a problem with, I guess, because I'm logical. I always felt like it was like a math problem or something like that. Like you had this information that it should fit a certain way or something like that.
Right.
And I never found writing to really work like that.
Yeah. So, and an outline assumes that there is a way. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. So outline is one of them. Yeah,
right. Well, maybe this has been said already in many different ways, but I find when I outline that I begin editing very early in the process.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's actually antagonistic to what I understand Peter Elbo and Natalie Goldberg are saying about don't cross out right away. That's the first thing that you do in an outline, is to begin, at least when I do it, is I begin crossing out before I've even started to put pen to paper, really.
Yeah, because it's an ordered scheme, it is forcing choices into the process. What's Roman numeral one, what's Roman numeral two, right? Now, and that is, so you are working to limit or to censor or to shape or to cross out or to arrange in some way. Now, I'll come back to this in a minute here. Let me see, I think I'll tear this off. Oh, I'm not going to be able to tear this off. Okay. Now, here's, let's do collecting. Collecting, so we've got outlining one, collecting two, and then we're going to do this thing called mapping, which is what you were talking about there. And what we're talking about here are other ways to generate material. Other ways to generate material. Free writing. Timed, non-stop intervals of writing. Right? Whether for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, or, as I said, another book, which is sort of this kind, but it's more about a creative work in general, and that's Julia Cameron's The Artist's Way. That's another book that I recommend. Again, written, I think, about early 1990s, maybe as late as 95. Julia Cameron's thing is 3 pages a day. 3 pages a day. We're all talking about how you just generate material, how you generate material. Pre-writing is how it is in schools now, talk about. How do you collect? How do you collect? We talked about this. You read things. You read any other way to collect?
Observation.
Observation. Anything else?
Listing.
Listing,
right.
Making a list. Anything else? Any other ways to collect? Yeah.
I don't know what the name of this is, but there's the just, you know, put your mind totally elsewhere.
Yeah.
And let it pop up.
Yeah. Yeah. So. You call it almost, I'll call it here, paradoxical meditation. Right? I mean, there's guided meditation, right? Where you actually force yourself to think on this. And then there's this other one where you sort of force yourself not to think about it and you just see what emerges, right? But this idea of putting yourself in kind of a trance-like state. Right? Kind of a trance-like state. Anything else?
Is brainstorming one of those?
Yeah. Brainstorming, sure. And again, the difference between free writing and brainstorming is simply the amount in which you write, the way in which you're kind of guiding your pen. But it's a similar thing, right? It's a similar thing. Now, mapping. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, to develop the counterbalance to whatever your theme is.
Yes, okay.
Build the negatives.
Right. And here, I call that imagine a dialogue. Imagine a dialogue in which here's one claim, what's the counterclaim, right? So that you actually are kind of pushing yourself to just build what it is you have to say by forcing yourself to say its opposite, however extreme or close it would be. Yeah.
And if you're doing like a research paper, is this when you would do thinking?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, and reading, I mean, what does it mean to read things? We can read in any range of intellectual modes, just as we can write in any range of intellectual modes. We can read casually, we can read sporadically, we can read accidentally, we can read purposefully, you know, and intently, and with a mind to really gather quotes and hard facts or data. Just leave it. Thank you. And I would say, as part of the spirit of this and the paradox of where knowledge comes from, that casual reading, as well as absolutely focused note-taking, I'm going to remember this source and I'm going to remember exactly what page it occurred on, that whole spectrum of reading behaviors is part of a good gathering process. Anybody know the writer Ian Fraser? Does this ring a bell? Ian Fraser is a contemporary nonfiction writer, a wonderful writer, who has written 2 books I recommend for completely different reasons. One book is called Great Plains. Those of you who are interested in Montana and the Dakotas and Wyoming and Kansas would find, if you're from that area of the country or you have geographical pull toward it, you'll find that book fascinating. He himself took a pilgrimage through the Great Plains and he wrote about it. As journalist, as historian, as naturalist, there's a whole range of styles of writing in there for the general reader. He was not writing as an expert to experts. He was writing as a traveler, a pilgrim, and he recounted his thoughts in that book, Great Plains. His most recent book is called Family, and if any of you are interested in family histories and in full-length biographies of families, I encourage you to take a look at this one, Ian Fraser, Family. His name is spelled Fraser. Now, in that book, Family, I'll be brief in this story. He's researching the Civil War. Because he goes back and he tries to trace his family history as far back as he can, which is actually at the beginning of the 19th century, a little bit there, and it goes all the way through, and there's a huge section on actually the Civil War and the families and which family members joined which regiments and so forth. So he spends time in the library, and he's describes how he'd go to the library and he's reading about this part of Ohio history. And he describes in this narrative how one day a woman, I think he said she was of Asian background and ethnicity, came in. The whole library, the reference room was completely empty except for his table. She came in and sat at the table directly next to him and began rustling with papers. She was an agitated reader and just couldn't quite get settled. And if you've ever known what it is when you're trying to be thoughtful and mindful and really pay focus, now here's this noise that's being made. And he struggled with whether or not he should change his seat. And he's having this battle. I mean, he completely loses his attention strand, and he has a battle within himself about whether or not he should move his seat. And he says, Now, I trust him as the authority on this. I don't believe he's made up this story, which is part of its power, that it's real. He says, in the midst of having this dialogue in his mind about should I move or should I stay, he leaned back in his chair just like this. And you know how in library reference things there are these stacks that are sort of, you know, just mid-height. They're not whole things, right? And they sometimes are on the walls and the tables are next to them. He goes like this, and because he went like this and he stretched out his hand actually brushed against the dissertation abstracts. It just so happened that he was in the reference area of dissertation abstracts, DAI International it's called, and he picked up one. I mean, he just saw it and he picked up one. And he just, you know, he was just taking a break. He just was trying to settle his mind and get back in focus. And he opens up the dissertation abstract, and as he starts going through the alphabet, he finds his father's dissertation abstract from the University of Ohio, 1935. Now, that became absolute center point of the story of researching the Civil War history. And you say, well, how do you get from dissertation abstracts in 1935 back to Ohio Regiment of 1865? Well, he made the leap because he talked about accident, serendipity, and what men are called to do because of the time they live in. Powerful, powerful vignette about accident and how it happens that even the most casual, distracted reading can illuminate in our mind's eye what it is we're trying to say. So I guess I say that when we're really gathering stuff as writers, it's important to realize any of it can go into the compost heap. Any of it can go into the compost heap. The most random newspaper headline, the thing we don't even read, the thing we overhear in a restaurant, you know, as well as the most sustained and systematic and tightly focused note-taking.
This is tangential, but do you have a technique for collecting?
Yeah, it's this really sloppy one. It's this. It's mostly this. I talked about this a little bit on Friday about journals. It's mostly this. I've taken now to index cards, 3x5 index cards, in which I just scribble things. But then I can't come up with a system to keep track of them. So I knew a writer once who put them all on a bulletin board in her office. She just had this huge wall, and she would just keep track of these things. And she just pinned them on her wall. And as she wrote, she would just kind of occasionally look up and stare at them, and then pull them off and use them that way. Okay, let's go back to this other thing here, mapping. And then we'll move back to the Natalie Goldberg's thing. What is mapping? The woman, can you talk a little bit about that? What's your sense of it as a process here?
Well, it can be, I think, more freeing than outlining for some people in that it's more, it seems more free-flowing, and you're actually organizing your thoughts in a way that makes sense to you about some material that you've read, or
right,
and it can be done in whichever way you want to.
Yeah.
It's a graphic. It's almost a visual.
Yeah.
A visual organizing scheme as opposed to a listening scheme. And that's what I think is important. Mapping was, as a technique, in my sense of when it came into the picture of writing classes and so forth, the woman's name was Gabrielle Rico. The book is called Writing the Natural Way. Again, I'm thinking this is early 80s. And she was the one who coined this thing of mapping, and she said what you do is, right, in the circle of a wide piece of paper, July. And rather than a sequential outline, which forces a linear step-by-step approach, this generative activity lets your mind take off in relation to itself and only itself, right? So for me, if I were going to write July, and if I were going to put it here, 1999, okay, first thing that comes to my mind is Iowa City, because I went there first in Iowa City. And the next thing that comes to my mind is teaching. And the next thing that comes to my mind is a woman named Anne that I met there. And the next thing that comes to my mind is a flower that I happened to watch open on a particular night. And then the next thing that comes to my mind is the fact that it was the anniversary of the moon launch. Okay? That's a whole lot of stuff. And then the other thing that's going on in July is Holden. And then there's all the webs of what it is at Holden that I've experienced. And each one creates its own network. Right? And then I go back to work. Because when I leave Holden, that's where I'm going to go. And I've got a host of things. This is an organizing thing, but it's not at all concerned with Roman numeral 1, Roman numeral 2, Roman numeral 3. It is simply a way of seeing where your mind goes. It's a visual kind of free writing. And it saves you from having to actually accumulate sentences or phrases or paragraphs. Okay? So, those three generative activities. All right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Storyboarding is a way of doing it. Forecasting, isn't it? This is a history book. I'm looking at what happened.
Well, because the topic is sort of autobiographical.
Yeah.
But you're saying for a story, to write a story?
If you're writing something and you don't know where it's going,
yeah.
You've got this collection of ideas.
Right, right.
I've seen people take them all on 3x5 cards and say, now let's see if you tried this and put
right.
them on the wall.
Rearrange them.
You can move them around right. and mm-hmm. move them in time and that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's get to Natalie. I'd like to finish at least with one free writing thing, but I want to get a little bit to this book here, a little more than I have. Apologize for that. Okay. Learning, here's Natalie Goldberg. This is a nutshell of what she's arguing. Learning to write is not a linear process. There's no logical ABC way to become a good writer. One neat truth about writing cannot answer it all. There are many truths. To do writing practice, and that's the way to think about it. To do writing practice. You know, again, this is the Zen voice in her, meditation practice. To do writing practice means to deal ultimately with your whole life. If you receive instructions on how to set a broken bone in your ankle, you can't use those same instructions to fill a cavity in your teeth. You might read a section in this book that says to be very specific and precise. That's to help the element of abstract general meandering. But then you read another chapter that says lose control, write on waves of emotion. Or in one chapter it says to fix up a studio, that you need a private place to write. The next chapter says get out of the house, away from the dirty dishes, go write in a cafe. Some techniques are appropriate at some time and some for other times. Every moment is different. One isn't wrong or right. When I teach a class, I want the students to be writing down the bones, the essential awake speech of their minds. The essential awake speech of their mind. If I were to let the essential awake speech of my mind hit the page, what would it sound like? What would it sound like? What would my writing feel like? But I also know I can't just say, okay, write clearly and with great honesty. So then she says, well, we're going to try these methods, okay? And this is another theoretical principle that I want to say here. Every writing project has its own rules, its own conditions, its own pieces, kinds of anxiety, There is no such thing as an experienced writer. There's no such thing as a truly experienced writer. Every new writing project, we gotta start, back to my thing I erased, we gotta start right there, and we gotta start with the fear that I'll never be able to write this. We have to learn how to write each new thing we write. It's true, the more you write, the more practice you get, the quicker you can move from the anxiety towards something else. But this notion though, I've written a book, I know how to write, doesn't work. Every new writing project, we have to relearn how to write, how to involve ourselves in the process. Okay, I talked about this notion of writing as practice. This is a great thing here. The metaphor she uses is running. Like running, the more you do it, the better you get at it. Some days you don't want to run and you resist every step of the 3 miles, but you do it anyway. You practice whether you want to or not. You don't wait around for inspiration and a deep desire to run. It'll never happen, especially if you're out of shape and have been avoiding it. But if you run regularly, you train your mind to cut through or ignore your resistance. You just do it. And she coined this, by the way, before the Nike logo made that phrase so famous in our culture. And in the middle of the run, you love it. When you come to the end, you never want to stop, and you stop hungry for the next time. You learn to trust your deep self more and not give in to your voice that wants to avoid writing. And she has this great question I think is so good for our culture. It is odd that we never question the feasibility of a football team practicing long hours for one game. Yet in writing, we rarely give ourselves the space for practice. How many times have we or people we know said, I've got a paper due tomorrow, I'll just work on it tonight? And from that, we assume that it will be a paper that has some measure of success. And that's the other paradox, is that I want to say. The free writing that we do is good stuff, has in it good stuff. But that doesn't matter. That doesn't mean it can be published or it can be, you know, it should be published in that way. That is to say, you trust the free writing as the most true form of writing, but you also know it's got to go through a strenuous process to get to a place where it's ready for readers. Okay? And then she talks about writing through the disappointments. And this is great. Let me just follow this thing. It's good, she says, it what keeps you in tune like a dancer, the reason you do free writing every day, it keeps you in tune like a dancer who does warm-ups before dancing, or a runner who does stretches before running. Runners never say, oh, I ran yesterday, I'm limber. Musicians never say, oh, I played a concert yesterday, I don't need to do scales. Right? Every day you practice. You do the scales, you do the warm-ups. You get your body limber, and you get your mind limber. And free writing is the best way of doing that. Okay? Think of writing practice as loving arms you come to illogically and incoherently. I love that metaphor. Writing is not a source of anxiety. Writing is a source of comfort. Writing is a shade tree. It's not something to be quarreled with. It's not water you fight with. It's a process that gives access to what it is that we have to say and want to say. Okay, let's see here. Where am I? Where are we? 4:43. You want to do some? Let's do some writing. Let's just do some writing before we go. Let's just kind of take some last 10 minutes. And here's what I'll say to kind of get us in the mood here. Sit down right now. Give me this moment. Write whatever's running through you. You might start with this moment and end up writing about the gardenia you wore at your wedding 7 years ago. That's fine. Don't try to control it. Stay present with whatever comes up and keep your hand moving. Let's do that for 8 minutes, and then I've got some other suggestions for us for the next couple of days. Keep your hand moving. Now, you could say to me, Nancy, I can do all this in my head. Why do I have to actually write this free writing stuff? Well, because part of the writing process is to connect the brain and the interior language of, and voice of ourself to paper. Whether we're doing the connecting with the paper through a computer, or we're connecting with it through pen, Natalie Goldberg has a whole thing here about tools, writing as practice, and beginner's mind, pen and paper. It's true, we've got to figure out a tool that makes us most comfortable. But the point is that the act of writing is a physical labor of producing language on paper. That's what writing is. And that's why free writing as an exercise is a little different than meditation. I mean, I believe the meditation, whether it's free or focused, can help us. But at some point, the writing's got to appear on paper, and that's physical labor, and we got to get ourselves up to that, up to the speed of that. I just want to talk to you about a center of gravity that occurred to me as I wrote, and I almost even stopped, but I forced myself to get going, okay? I'll just read this. I learned today, doing this Enneagram thing, I learned today that I might be a 6 with a 7 wing, or maybe a 7 with a 6 wing. What the hell does that mean? Well, it means that my deepest fear is to be alone, to be left alone, and that I'm a bit more comfortable with systems than I ever would have imagined. Of course, I realize now that's why the sabbatical, this is a part of my life when I left school system, was such a disaster. That's why the summers when I don't have an explicit connection to an institution are always so hard. I need that structure. I need that sense of order, calm, and maintenance. I need a degree of order, of connection. I say I want to be alone, but really that's the worrisome place where I start to panic. That's what the 6 tells me. I am faithful, abiding to systems, at home with rules and authority. I went to Woodstock and my best friend was a policeman. True. I went to Woodstock and in fact one of the best people I met there was a policeman. And that's where an essay begins for me, right there. Yeah. Select that. Line. I went to Woodstock and my best friend became a policeman. So that goes on the top of the page for me tonight, and I write from that. And what I would do with the visual mapping thing is it's Woodstock in the center, or even Al Parker Jr., which was his name. Al Parker Jr. goes in the center, and then the visual map, and then more periods of sustained writing. From each of them, I cull the center of gravity. And that's how the thing starts to take shape. I don't worry about an outline of everything I'm going to say about Woodstock and Al Parker Jr. Because I don't even know what that is yet. Right? I let myself discover what it is I've got to say. And this is what we'll talk about on Thursday. Then when you enter into the process where you're starting to think about readers, you start to give shape to it. You let it cook. And then you give shape to it. Okay, on Thursday, what I would like us to do is have a kind of writing workshop. And here's what's going to happen for those of you who want to come, and people are going to come new, I realize as well. Some of you may have writing that you'd like to share. We're not going to make copies of it. We're just going to share it in very small groups, small circles of people, 2 or 3 or 4. And if you have writing that you maybe would like to read, or portions of these writings that you'd like to read aloud, that would be great. If not, what we're going to do is actually spend some time doing some free writings and then just read them aloud, portions that we want. But the thing I want to talk about is, how do you construct a writing group that can be most productive for you as a writer? So if you're in a writing group or you're thinking of starting one, Peter Elbow calls it the teacherless writing class. That's kind of what we're going to do on Thursday. So I just want to warn you, if you're going to come on Thursday, I'd encourage you to bring some of the writing that you have. Here's a couple of other last tips from Natalie Goldberg. And I'll just mention these for you for if you want prompts. If you want, the whole book is filled with prompts, by the way. That's what this book is. They're very short. They're just about 2 pages each. And that's why this is a handier book than Peter Elbow's, because she actually kind of gives you starting places, you know, jump boards, springboards that you can use. Begin with, I remember. Write lots of small memories. If you fall into one large memory, write that. Just keep going. Don't be concerned if the memory happened 5 seconds ago or 5 years ago. Everything that isn't this moment is memory coming alive again as you write. If you get stuck, just repeat the phrase, I remember again, and keep going. So that's one prompt, I remember. take something you feel strongly about, whether it's positive or negative, and write about it as though you love it. Go as far as you can, writing as though you love it, then flip over. This is what you were talking about, sir. Then flip over and write about the same thing as though you hate it. Then write about it perfectly neutral. Choose a color, any color, your favorite color. Pink, for example. Take a 15-minute walk. Holden Village is a great place to do this. Take a walk, and on your walk, and this is where the generating thing, observing, I don't know who said that, but it's a great thing. On your walk, notice wherever there is pink. Come back to your notebook and write about it for 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. Write in different places, right? Try 10 minutes of free writing in the village center. Try 10 minutes of free writing after Vespers. Try 10 minutes of free writing in your bed when you wake up in the morning. And in each of those places, write what is going on around you. Visualize a place that you really love. Be there. See the details. Now write about it. This is sort of came up yesterday in Vespers about Heartland. It could be a corner of your bedroom, an old tree you sat under one whole summer, a table at McDonald's in your neighborhood, a place by the river. Now this is the key thing. What colors are there? What do you see, touch, taste, smell, and hear when you go to that place? See, touch, taste, hear, and feel. That's the most important inventory of any writer in the world. Seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, feeling. What is your first memory? That's another problem. What's your first memory? Your first memory, co-reclaim. So when you say, I remember, try and push yourself on what it is. We're doing a class in here. Who are the people that you've loved? Who are the people that you loved? Who are the people that you can't stand? That's what Natalie Goldberg means when she says go for the jugular. Who are the people that you can't stand? Write about them. Write about them. Write about, and this is where she's, you know, really kind of cuts the edge. She's writing down the bones. Write about how you learned about sex. Write about your first sexual experience. Write about the closest you ever felt to God. Don't be abstract. Write the real stuff. Be honest and detailed. Here's one more prompt. Take a poetry book, or I would say any book. Go to the reference library and just do what Jean Fraser did. Pull off the book from the shelf, any book. Grab a line, write it down, and continue from there. Okay? Put someone else's line at the top of your page and write from there. Okay, those are good prompts, I think, to help us get started. And Thursday we'll talk about we'll talk about moving the process outward from the personal, the intimate free writing down the bones, to audiences, to readers, and what happens in that process and how can it be productive. So that's where we'll be on Thursday.
Is there another class tomorrow?
No, day off, so write tomorrow. Write tomorrow. Thursday, hike tomorrow, observe. Pick a color, observe it, stop, give yourself 10 minutes. Okay, and then Thursday we'll do workshops, Friday we'll do journals, and then Saturday Nancy Remeloff and I will talk about fairy tales and we'll try and kind of actually write some. Okay, thanks everybody.